Welcome to the IFRS strategy session. So this session is not a technical IFRS session, so if you want to find out how to do IFRS, then you're definitely in the wrong place. What we're talking about here is basically the implications of IFRS 17. So what's this going to mean for companies, for management of companies, for the preparers of the accounts, and for users of the accounts? So we have three people on the panel today who are each going to give a brief overview and introductory comments. And share a little bit of their insights from their particular areas of expertise. And then we'll open the floor to questions from both from the audience, and I've got a few pre-prepared myself, really go through what this is going to mean when we see this change come through in a couple of years' time. So on the panel, first up to speak will be Brendan Cantle. Brendan's a partner in EY's actuarial practice based in Sydney. 18 years' experience in life insurance and wealth management across Australia, New Zealand, South Africa and Asia-Pacific region. And Brendan's heavily involved in the IFRS work, both with the Institute and with the accounting profession. Next is Siddharth Paramaswaran. Siddharth's J.P. Morgan's lead insurance and diversified financial equity research analyst. Siddharth focuses on Australia and New Zealand. His background's in general insurance, investment management, and is a consulting actuary with Tillinghast. And then Jennifer Lang. Jennifer Lang's the CFO and Chief Actuary of Commonshore. So she's been in the industry on within companies looking at preparation of accounts and seen the introduction of margin on services and the first round of IFRS when things have changed a little bit, and seen this from a practitioner's point of view in terms of what impact it has on management reporting and management decisions within an organisation. So we'll try and keep the presentations to about 5 to 10 minutes each, so there's plenty of time for discussion once presenters are finished. Okay, I'll hand over to Brendan.
Thanks, Daniel. Bear with me for a moment. Thanks for the introduction, Daniel. So very quickly, what we're going to talk about, I will run through some of the higher-level impacts of IFRS 17. Siddharth will put a bit of an analyst view on what this might mean for life insurers. And Jennifer will have a look at what it means for managing the business. And as Daniel said, we'll try and run through the presentation reasonably quickly so that we can leave plenty of time for questions at the end. Okay, just brief introduction. So IFRS 17 will replace our current accounting standard for life insurance, AASB 1038. It will also replace AASB 4 from 1 Jan 2021. So hopefully most of you will be aware of that and familiar with the timelines, etc. What I will do is just quickly cover a lot of text on this slide, but what I thought I'd do is cover 7 of the key changes and what they might mean for P&L, balance sheet, profit volatility, which will be in the following slides. These are probably some of the big changes, but there are obviously many, many more, which we won't have time to go through today. This is from the perspective of a life insurer, so a typical Australian life insurer that's writing a combination of yearly renewable term type business and perhaps a bit of legacy participating business as well. So this slide just summarises some of the key new requirements from the standard, and I'm hoping that most of this will be fairly familiar to most people in the audience. So we've got a lower level of grouping for profit reporting. That means we've got profit recognition at a lower level than we currently have compared to related product groups that we currently have. We've got these concepts of a liability for remaining coverage and a liability for incurred claims, very, very broadly. Liability for remaining coverage relating to future events, liability for incurred claims, things that happened in the past. that's probably reasonably familiar to most of you under the current accounting standard. But why is that important under IFRS 17 is because some of the assumption changes that we might be putting through profit margins under margin on services at the moment will effectively go to the P&L because of claims reserve being split out in the liability for incurred claims. We've got this new concept of a contract boundary, and the potentially significant implications that has if YRT step premium is classified as short duration. A new risk adjustment for non-financial risk, so that's another another component of the liability that will be run off over time and released through the P&L. Reinsurance, which got a bit of discussion in one of the earlier sessions today, very complex area of the new standard. The key thing to remember there is the reinsurance contracts will be separately valued to the underlying direct contracts. So that has some quite significant implications for measurement and potentially some mismatching there between the P&L that's brought about by the reinsurance contract and that of the underlying contract. The final two there, we've got expense apportionment and attribution is going to be slightly different under the standard. So there's the expense cash flows must be directly attributable to the portfolio of insurance contracts. What does that mean? Effectively, means some expenses that we might be pushing through liabilities at the moment may no longer be able to be included in that liability measurement, and therefore would go straight to the P&L. Quite a wide that one's quite open to interpretation still, I think. And the final point, which I think will be relevant for many life insurers in Australia, is just one that relates to participating contracts. And I think there was a session on this just before, which I missed, but that's the new approach for valuing PAR contracts. The variable fee approach is quite different to what we're used to now under current MOS reporting. So those are seven of the key changes. As I said, they're not all of them, but those are the ones that I'm just going to talk briefly to today and what the implications might be for a P&L balance sheet of a typical life insurer. So the next two slides, I'm just going to walk through some initial views of what the potential impacts might be. I'm hoping to get some discussion on this going a bit later on, so we'll see if people agree with me on this. We'll see what others think, but these are just some initial thoughts that I've come up with based on some of those observations on the previous slide. So what this table shows is just the key change per the previous slide, key products affected, and then what might happen to an opening net asset position, future profit. For the business and future profit volatility. I've got arrows there for, I guess, directional impacts, and we'll see if people agree with these. The colouring, I didn't put in a legend, but the current colouring is, I guess, very broadly green, represents a favourable impact, if you like. For the business, red is potentially an unfavourable impact, yellow is sort of could go either way, or we don't know. So if I work through them all quickly at a very high level, we've got lower level of grouping. The opening net asset position, remember, any changes to the opening net assets will go through retained profits, so there is no day one impact of this. So we've got potentially less cross-subsidisation between groups, potentially higher liabilities there. Hence, opening net asset position falls. I put that as a favourable because that means that future profit, in theory, all else being equal, will be higher. But obviously, there's a lot of nuances in there that we sort of need to work through. having said that, then I guess it depends on the business profile as to whether that lower level of grouping eventually results in a favourable future profit profile or otherwise, and obviously whether the products themselves are profitable. So that's the key one there. Volatility. I thought that there would be lower volatility potentially, although I know this is a point that's been debated due to the lower level of grouping. So you're potentially getting more products going into loss recognition over time, but the dollar impact of those might not be as large as we see under current MOS. The next point, the liability for remaining coverage and liability incurred claims. I think the key point there was just really income protection claims reserves. Any changes to termination rate assumptions on those reserves will impact the P&L. Now, I know a lot of those portfolios are in loss recognition at the moment, so that's probably not really a change. But if there was profit margins there, then that would be something new under the standard. The contract boundary point for stepped YRT, that one hopefully is sort of reasonably well known to most of you. We've got potentially a large write-off of deferred acquisition costs or negative policy liabilities at transition. What that means for future profit probably depends on things like your new business profile versus the current in-force profile. Potentially it does have a favourable impact on ROE, depending on how you're measuring that. And I think it's probably fair to say that if that large DAC does get written off, you're going to have less volatility around things like lapse rates, interest rates, etc. The risk adjustment. So I think the key products there impacted are going to be those with the large incurred claims liabilities. So think your income protection, any group risk products with large IBNRs, we're going to be putting a risk adjustment on top of those reserves. That will obviously increase your liabilities at transition, and the future ongoing profit impacts of that will depend a lot on the claims profile, so whether your claims liabilities are running off or growing over time. Future profit volatility, I thought that would be higher just because you've obviously got now any changes to reserves are going to be magnified by this risk adjustment. Reinsurance is probably the one that's most uncertain. The key potential issue there is mismatching between the contract boundary and what does that mean. I think the one thing that is pretty certain is the volatility will increase as a result of the reinsurance changes. They are very complex and I think in most people's minds probably flawed, but we're going to have to live with them. Directly attributable expenses, I think that one's fairly wide open at the moment, and it will also depend on how much businesses that you've got in the long duration category. I think if it's short duration, it's probably not so much of an impact, but could be potentially material depending on where the interpretations go. And the variable fee approach for those that have participating business is also one that's, I think, very uncertain. So I've just put question marks there. And I guess I'd be interested in any comments from anyone who's done more work on that particular one. So that was a very quick whiz through of some of the high level impacts, and look forward to having a bit of a discussion on some of that to see whether people agree later in the session.
Okay, great. Thank you, everyone. Thank you to the Institute for asking me to speak here. This is my third session on insurance accounting. I feel like I'm being typecast as someone who can talk about these issues. I do have other things I can talk about as well for the next conference. So, but for the moment, I'm going to stick to AASB 17 and what it might mean for equity markets. Now, I'm going to try and leave you with four messages today. The first one is basically that people in markets actually have limited attention spans on nuances around accounting, but it's not that it doesn't matter. It does matter, but it's just that people are quite limited in their knowledge about changes in accounting. I'll get to that. I'll go through some of the problems that people on my side of the fence, on the investment side of the fence, have in interpreting accounts, just to give you some flavour of what we look for and what would be helpful for us. I'll go through how I think accounting does actually influence real outcomes in the life insurance context, and then I'll just have some suggestions from my side of the fence as I see it, as to issues that could be helpful for a smooth transition to the new accounting standards. Just to set the scene, I think, you know, from my side of the fence, when we look at the life insurance industry, we have seen a lot of transactions occurring in the market at the moment, you know, both reinsurance and sales. And, you know, it's almost the entire listed industry seems to have just disappeared to the unlisted space, either through reinsurance transactions or through direct sales. And there's potentially more still up for up for grabs. So, I suppose one of the key questions I just wanted to leave with you is just, you know, did accounting actually have a part to play in this? And just how well understood is MOS in the markets, and whether, you know, just a lack of understanding of it actually allowed for this transition to occur. When these transactions have been pitched to investors, they're pitched as having been a very good deal for the seller. You know, typically they're done at 18 times earnings, which sounds like a very high multiple, particularly if you're a bank and you're trading on 13 times, or even if you're a wealth manager. All these transactions have seemed very good. But for the buyer, it's also seemed very good at the same time. You know, typically they will tell their investors, well, we've been able to buy a business at 1x EV, which sounds like a fantastic deal. All these transactions have occurred, and it seems like there's actually been a complete move in just the whole life insurance space, as I said, from the listed space to the unlisted space. And as I say, part of it, in my view, is just how the different groups are looking at these things. My view is that I don't think that the market has been fully aware of MOS. Certainly the knowledge might have been much greater in the past, but I think some of that knowledge has faded, and I think it's allowed some of these movements to occur. How aware are investors about IFRS 17? I'd say that I think that almost none of my clients who are fund managers would be aware the accounting standards are changing on the insurance side. Maybe there'd be one or two who are aware of it, but the knowledge is very limited, even though it's coming in a couple of years. And you might ask, why is this? It seems, obviously, I'm sure it's seen as fundamental to your world, but if you look at it from a fund manager's perspective, even if we just focus on the listed space, the only listed players in the financial space who have life operations now are AMP, Suncorp, and Clearview, and you know, that's an estimate there of the embedded value. It might be around $4 billion out of the market cap of the ASX 200 is, you know, over $2 trillion. And even within financial stocks, that EV would probably represent less than 1% of financial stocks, 0.2% of the whole market. So, you know, nuances around accounting are you know, very easily lost on investors. So I just want to leave you with that. That is my first message. My second message is really just around problems that we have with interpreting accounts, just to give you some perspective of what we try and do, and anything that can help us understand some of these issues would be useful. So, where there's a gross mismatch between profit and cash, that does that is a key issue for us, because obviously Moz allowed some of this to occur with issues like DAC. I mean, it's not an issue of Moz. It is just that Moz provides a framework for actually smoothing some of these issues in YRT contracts. So ultimately what investors care about is cash, and anything that helps us understand that is useful. Understanding sustainability, the more any detail which can help us understand what is sustainable and what isn't is useful. And understanding volatility is also useful, because quite often if we have an earnings number and we don't really understand how different that could be over time, that also is an issue. And in the past, I think if you go back maybe to the financial crisis and crises before that, one of the issues is that often investors didn't understand embedded options. The third message that I wanted to leave you with was just around the fact that real outcomes can be influenced by accounting treatments. As I mentioned, the issue there, in my view, of the whole ownership structure of the life insurance industry, in my view, at least in part, has changed because of these issues. Contract structures in YRT with high upfront commissions allow mismatches in incentives. I suppose the message that I want to give here is that approaches like Moz, in my view, have allowed for the industry to basically get lazy with contract structures, and it's basically allowed things like businesses to assume that they will make profits over a long period of time, take high upfront costs, and assume that they'll be able to earn them back over time, without the appropriate structures and contracts to make sure that incentives are aligned. Things like surrender penalties, etc., just no longer exist. You could have these high upfront commissions, which you could still assume that you would make good profits into the future. The final message that I just wanted to leave you with is that from my perspective, as I said, knowledge is about the changes are low, but they will have an impact in what we see. I think that it's important to keep us engaged in terms of what the impacts will be. So we appreciate sessions like this and any sessions that you might do for investors in another forum would, I think, be quite useful. The second thing is anything that we can get around detail around what's actually going on with the underlying economics of the business, which I think is one of the intents of the new standards, would be very useful for us. So I might just leave it at that and pass on. To Jennifer.
So thanks, Siddharth. As the introduction said, I'm representing the business side of how we manage with contracts like this. And we've actually been on a panel like this probably 4 years ago. So probably for those of you who are in the room then, it's actually not changed all that much, but it's a little bit closer. So it's interesting to reflect on what might change in the business with changes in accounting treatments. So first question is, does actually the way we measure profit affect how we manage the business? I've heard a lot of people in my team talk about how the economics of the business hasn't really changed, so why should it change anything? And I think Siddharth's given you some really good examples of why that's true. And pretty much every part of the businesses that we're in are ultimately listed somewhere. So we do the owners of our capital might not be in Australia, but they're still mostly listed somewhere on a stock exchange somewhere, and what they report to their owners matters. So how they report to their owners matters. So I guess how does the way we measure our profit change how we manage our business? And I believe it really does, because we tend to use key performance indicators related to profit. We give management attention to things that will change our profit. So anyone who's been involved in a business where we're coming towards a loss recognition point on a particular line of business, we'll know that there's a lot more management attention paid to that business when it's close to loss recognition than it was further away. The economics of the change that's happening to that business might not be that different in two different places where they had different upfront costs, and so one's in loss recognition and one isn't, but we know that it changes the dynamic. So my view is, for example, that the group business has actually taken quicker action because group business, fundamentally, the accounting changes the profit recognition faster than some of our retail business. So that's management attention. Many people measure their risk appetite using a profit measure. So if you measure your risk appetite using a volatility of profit, then the way in which your profit moves will change how you take risks. How you measure your economic capital is often actually looking at underlying profits as well as the economics of the business. And, of course, bonuses are often related to profit, not just a value measure, or not even a value measure. And there might be a profit and something else, but they generally have a profit in there somewhere. So all of those things means that you do pay attention. So Brendan talked about some of the implications of the changes on that profit. What are the things that might change the way in which we manage our business? So if our reported profits are more volatile, then we look like we have a riskier business. According to all those measures that I talked about before, we might actually take more steps than we would have previously to reduce that volatility. So we might actually be more likely to hedge some investment returns because we can't control some of the other volatility and we can control that. Cross-subsidisation is no longer going to be as hidden. Now, actually, the most interesting example for me is from my general insurance side. In my general insurance portfolio right now, my whole retail portfolio is one, what we call related product group on the life insurance side. So there's cross-subsidisation in there between home and contents and between home and contents and motor. You can't see what that is, but I won't any longer be able to separate to show that as one. I'll have to show that as a number of separate groups. And I think that the behaviour of the market when the cross-subsidisation becomes obvious is actually going to change the pricing of those contracts. So I'm sure you can all think of examples in life insurance where that's going to change. There are a number of different lines of business which are more or less profitable, and we can show them together. When we have to show them separately, it's going to become more obvious and our behaviour will change. The one that Siddharth talked about, of course, the one that the life insurance, particularly the retail side, is most interested in, is upfront costs expense at time of sale. And that's not just commission, it's all of our costs. The fact that we will now, if we have a contract boundary that is 1 year, have to expense our commission and our upfront costs is, I believe, going to change our behaviour. And the other one that I'm not really sure about how it's going to change things, but it clearly is the fact that the reinsurance and the direct contracts will no longer be as closely linked as they have been in accounting. So I think that there will be definite changes there in how we manage our reinsurance as direct players and how reinsurers manage their own negotiations with the direct players. So there's a lot of things going on in the industry at the moment, which means that people haven't had time to think about all of these things, but I think it's important that we actually have at least some of this in the back of our minds. So business changes that might emerge. I've talked a little bit about some of these already. So commission and upfront expenses managed more tightly. When something actually hits your bottom line and it's reported in your profit, it tends to get more attention. So if it just shows as a nice smooth expense over the lifetime of a contract, it probably doesn't get as much attention as something that happens this year. So I think that we'll see, notwithstanding the changes that have already happened in LIF, we'll see more changes to commission rates when they come clearly into the bottom line. Loss-making business will be clearer earlier. So I think insurance cycles are probably going to be a bit shorter than they were for those contracts where the change brings it closer. Cross-subsidisation between business lines will be visible, and hence I think it will be reduced. That distinction between direct and overhead expenses. So I think that will probably mean that the expenses that are overhead expenses that can't then be allocated and smoothed are also going to get more attention. So I think pretty much everyone in the room is an overhead. So we're all going to be managed more tightly. But at the same time, we're going to have a lot of work putting this in, so it's probably a little bit in the distance, but just remember that as an overhead, we need to make sure that we're adding value to the business. And then I guess the other thing that I don't believe that most of our product managers have thought about very much at all, and that's our job to help them understand this, is that product changes will definitely happen over time to optimise profit emergence. So what does that mean exactly? I think it depends on the line of business you're talking about. But I think that we'll gradually see people trying to change the way their products work so that the profit emergence will be optimised, whatever that means for the company that we're talking about. That might be a smoother, less volatile profit emergence. It might be matching more closely what the upfront costs are. And there's a number of different ways that that might happen, but I think that those are the kinds of changes that I can see happening. Now, I went to the IFRS task force presentation, and I realised going to that I know a lot less about IFRS than at least half the people in this room. So this is me as a business advisor thinking through what are the kinds of things that I can see coming to us that might change our behaviour as a business, more than the detail of the IFRS changes that will affect our business. So I expect that there'll be a lot of people in the room will have other things that will change our profit emergence that will therefore change how we as a business respond to that. But I'm also interested when we get to the Q&A if anyone has got a contrary view about whether profit management does drive business behaviour, because there are people who do say that, you know, the economics of this business hasn't changed. So it'll be interesting to see how strongly people think that that will emerge. So that's everything I had to say, and I'm handing over to Daniel as your chair.
Thank you to the panel for the introductory remarks and comments. We will now hand over to the floor for questions. I have a few prepared if we don't have anybody to start straight away. Is anybody, anyone jumping up to the microphone? No? Okay, we'll go. Well, I'll ask the last question, but I'll ask it first to the panel. Improvement or a step backwards? Where are we going with IFRS 17 versus MOS? Do you think it's going to improve the transparency of accounts, make it easier for the business to manage, or are we entering into a world where we've got more problems than we're solving? I'll give the easy question to Brendan to start with.
I'll defer back to some comments that Siddharth made, that I think we do take it a little bit for granted that MOS is, because we understand margin on services pretty well, most of us in this room, that others do as well. I'm not sure that that's necessarily the case for your average user of the accounts. So while there is a lot of complexity in this standard, and when you sort of start looking at it, you just go, it sort of blows you away. How are we going to understand this? What value is this providing? I think it will make things more transparent, as Jennifer has alluded to, because there is going to be a lot more disclosure around more granular levels of profitability, etc. And I think it does make them more comparable with other industries and other jurisdictions around the world. So, look, improvement or step backwards, from a narrow view, I'd say probably a step backwards, but I think if you take a broader view, it's probably an improvement.
So if you touched on do the users of accounts really understand that? And you also mentioned that you're often using normalised earnings, so maybe in the context of answering, you could question, do you think you'll just continue doing the same of looking for a normalised number and normalising from a different basis, or will something change in that transparency which may be coming through?
I mean, on the issue of... actually, there's just a point that I just want to follow up on what Brendan said, which is just around... So in terms of whether I think it's a step forward or a step back, From the listed markets perspective, I think not deferring a whole bunch of costs for a long period of time, I think is a good thing. The potential risk is that a fast growing company might be penalised, but it's the same in every industry. We've seen fast growing general insurers where they don't get to defer costs, and I think that people understand that there is. That they're investing for growth. So, and if they believe that it'll ultimately be profitable, then they'll still be rewarded for it. So I think it's a step forward. In terms of the issue of normalized earnings and the like, the market actually today does use normalized earnings for some companies. They actually present a non-IFRS method of of showing their accounts. And I think that, you know, if companies want to do that, they can, as long as they still focus on the IFRS as their main method of disclosure. So I think that that'll still be looked at. So if you want to show us something different, if you want to give us a different message, I think that you'll still get a lot of airplay in the market.
I was a great supporter of Moz when it first came in. It seemed very logical to me, and perhaps that's my actuarial background showing through. But some of those behavioural things that I've just outlined, I think it's actually been, yeah, it has been counterproductive in some way. So although the complexity that we are expecting in the short term feels too much, I actually think we're going to get a better outcome at the end of it. So the next 5 years, probably not, but after 5 years, maybe.
Any questions from the room? Oh, is it my turn again? No? Here we go.
Thanks very much for that presentation, especially Jennifer on the commercial realities. I think that's a really good reminder that actually accounting and outcomes really does drive profit, and anybody who's been inside a large company realises that management is very much focused on their bonuses, as the Royal Commission has shown. But the real challenge in all of this is effectively, I think, how do you get the benefit? And I think the benefit kind of comes, the more stuff you get into PAA, the simpler the management is, the simpler the accounting is, the more directed it is, and you get all the good outcomes you've been praising on the group business, which may explain why some of the faster-growing life insurers started from a group insurance background in the retail space. But I think the other challenge is effectively what you do with the par book. Park it to one side and hope that they've got enough margins to absorb the complexity.
I must admit, from a business perspective, I haven't looked at the PAR book. I've kind of been waiting for people to figure out what happens before we decide whether we need to take action.
Well, really good news for people that have got PAR book and loss recognition, we add a risk adjustment.
Thanks. Richard.
Aren't we all waiting for AMP as far as the PAR book's concerned? I'd like to echo what Jennifer has said and Siddharth as well. I remember years ago listening to a then young product actuary talking about the upfront costs in the product and saying, but that's all right, we recover them from the future margins. And what that does is it completely internalizes that whole issue of what you spend and what you risk. So that's a good outcome, I think, out of this. But it's almost accidental. It only exists if we have short boundary business. And what it doesn't do is fix the major fault in Moz, which was that it put the DAC on the actuarial side instead of the accounting side. And it still does that with anything that doesn't have a short boundary. Well, that's my view. I just wonder what yours is.
I'd agree with that view, Richard. And I guess, that probably goes to some of the questions around how organisations might respond to this vis-a-vis product and strategy types changes. So in particular, what outcome do they want, and therefore what changes could they make to the product to get that outcome? But yes, I absolutely agree. If you're in a long duration contract boundary, then you're still going to be able to defer a lot of those upfront acquisition costs.
Just to add to that, I know many companies, including my own, actually put the DAC on the asset side of the balance sheet, even though it's incredibly complex to understand how it works, but just to make it easier for management to understand what's happening. So maybe that gives you, the user of the accounts is actually doing that already. So I tend to agree with your point that it is accidental, and it's probably a positive.
Probably just a question for the panel. Could you tell me, how would you explain to a policyholder that we're changing your premium rates because of a change in accounting treatment?
I mean, from my perspective, I wouldn't have thought that you would necessarily. You might change over time, hopefully. I think that some things would result in changes in contract design, but you know, I mean, no high upfront commissions and the like, which anyway is happening. But I would have thought that hopefully you wouldn't necessarily change the pricing.
Yeah,
maybe I've missed the nuances of some of these changes.
Yeah, I guess again, coming back to the point I made earlier about how many people outside of the actuarial profession actually understand the detailed mechanics of MOS or IFRS 17. Probably not that many, and I think all of this will be more transparent on the financial statements, so those users of the accounts can, you know, still see if there is a upfront cost and the way that the company is treating that business. So, you know, again, I sort of echo Siddharth's comments. I don't know that would necessarily, you'd think, result in a change to premium rates per se.
I guess I imagine it's going to be easier than explaining to an advisor why their commission is changing because of an accounting treatment. But I guess, I mean, the example I gave was deliberately general insurance because in many ways it's clearer. If there are cross subsidisations that are hidden and then they become obvious, it is potentially as easy as it ever is to change to explain a premium change to explain that this one is. We're not charging you enough for the claims that happen in this portfolio, and this one we're charging you too much for the claims that happen in this portfolio, provided you do both at once. But there is no easy way to explain a price increase to a customer. I think anyone who's in marketing would know that. You know, it's any customer doesn't like a price increase. I hate it when it happens to me. So there's no easy way.
Anyone else from the floor? No. Paul?
Two really kind of quick questions. The first is, if we go into the long-term contracts and we introduce the concept of risk margins, for, say, level premium-type risk products, your risk margin theoretically could be the substantial portion of your profit margin. And so is that going to push a lot more of these types of products into loss recognition? I suppose my first question. And the second question was more around, given the volatility that we're going to see in profit earnings, particularly around acquisition costs, do we think we're going to move more to a measurement of value based on embedded value as opposed to accounting profitability?
So on the first point, I think, yes, if there is a risk adjustment in the liability for remaining coverage, then that will eat into the contractual service margin or the profit margin. So, again, for a long duration contract, that would mean that you've got less future CSM to release. But remember that the risk adjustment will also be released over time through the P&L. So, you know, it gets a little bit nuanced then between the pattern of the CSM release and the pattern of the risk adjustment, I think. But yes, you can potentially push contracts into loss recognition if you're not careful with your risk adjustment. So yes, that would be the answer. One, the embedded value, I don't know if you've got a comment.
Sorry, I couldn't actually hear this.
So, well, correct me if I'm wrong. I think the question was, will there be more focus on embedded value type reporting under this when this standard comes into place?
So on that second question, Paul, I think that my view is there wasn't a lot of focus on embedded values amongst fund managers at all recently. I think there was when MOS first came out, if I go back 10 years or so, but just the level of disclosures around embedded values really, really fell away. So really the knowledge about it, I think, also fell away, and I don't think that was looked at very much. So can't see it being looked at any less than it was currently. So on your first question, I think it's pretty similar in general insurance with their risk margins. I think if you write a, I mean, you can put business into it, be a long tail business if your profit margins aren't high enough. I think you can have a, you can, if, am I missing the point?
Theoretically,
yeah.
For a long
tail
risk product, you really don't have financial risks, but it's minor. So when you have yep. to set your risk margins based on non financial risks, you could actually see the profit margin.
Yep.
So it's going to potentially push a lot more of the long term products
yep.
that are predominantly risk based into loss recognition, even though there is a need to the margins, it just doesn't exceed your risk margin.
No, I understand. I mean, it's the same in general insurance, though, with, you know, some risks are not financial, the risk of claims. If you write CTP insurance, it's the same issue. The market still deals with that. I think people wouldn't take on that risk if there wasn't some risk margin in there. You wouldn't take it on for nothing. So if it was a fair contract, I think it's still... no one would buy that with zero profit margins embedded in it.
But I think that's probably a point that, you know, maybe it's not as profitable as you think it is, because ultimately you should be making a return for your risk as well as a return for just the best estimate. I just did want to say that I do think embedded value reporting will increase, and I think that's partly for the growth companies being able to make the case strongly that their upfront costs are worth spending. But the fact that their upfront costs will be clear will mean that they'll probably be lower than they would have been otherwise, if that makes sense.
We have about 4 minutes left, if there's any further questions.
Could the panel please comment on the internationalisation of the standard, as in the first time that Australian insurers will be comparable to international insurance?
A comment that I'd make, and Siddharth might have a view on this, would be you would think that at least for the listed companies, that the way that they present their accounts and some of the perhaps accounting policy options that they might look to take would align over time with whatever becomes global market practice. So you would expect that there might be an influence from wherever global practice goes on the various options and the way that the standard is being interpreted for the listed players, at least. I don't know if you have a view on that.
I'm not aware how other companies around the world are interpreting the standard.
I actually think you saw some of the answer in Siddharth's presentation, where he compared what the Australians said about the purchase price and what the overseas people said about the purchase price, and they both got a great, fantastic deal. That probably won't be as easy to do once we've all got the same accounting standards. So don't know whether that will mean that we won't have the same level of M&A at that point, or more or less. I don't know, but it will be different.
Anything else? Okay, we're 1 minute to go, so I'll just take the opportunity to thank the panel for a great presentation and discussion. And I do need